Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderators for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Breast Cancer in African American Women. This is a very important call that we're doing, and lots of information, and I know you'll have lots of questions during the Q&A period. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and over 32 other cancer organizations, and it's because of that collaboration that we have reached so many of you on this call today. We have on the call today over 851 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from large cities and small cities, from rural and frontier communities, and from suburban areas. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, Indonesia, and Pakistan, so really from all over the world. And it is a credit to each of you that you have chosen to spend the next hour with us. I would like to turn your attention to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers and what they're going to cover. There also is an outline of some of the topics, and there's resource information about all those over 32 organizations that we have partnered with that you can utilize as free resources to contact for additional information after this program. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us what programs we should offer and what topics? And indeed, the program of today was one that has been many of you have requested over and over again. So please let us know what you'd like us to offer as a topic, and we'll very much try to implement it. It is sort of beginning of a new year, and we're happy to put in new programs as you recommend them. So I want to thank you for that. Now, today's program is made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, just really the best speakers, and I'm going to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Edith Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell is clinical professor of medicine and medical oncology. She is with the Department of Medical Oncology. She's associate director of diversity programs, Kimmel Cancer Center, Thomas Jefferson University. Now, Dr. Mitchell has been a frequent presenter on our programs, really. She's just been wonderful. And she is going to address the following topics: breast cancer in African American women, concerns of African American women living with breast cancer, communicating with the healthcare team, and the issue of clinical trials. Dr. Mitchell?
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner. It is a pleasure to be with you on this exciting program and a pleasure to work with you again. The topic today is really one that is very, very important, and I thank you for bringing together such a large group of individuals. Breast cancer in African American women is really one that is very important, yet it is one that is not discussed in many circles. For African American women, breast cancer is the most common cancer diagnosis and one that is really very important, and important because African American women are more likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer at a later stage of the disease, meaning that the tumors are larger and tend to have spread to other areas, including the lymph nodes, as well as other sites of disease. Not only do African American women tend to have tumors that have spread to other areas more rapidly, African American women also tend to have faster growing tumors are tumors that are more aggressive and therefore very important for diagnosis and treatment. With the more aggressive tumors, although African American women have a lower incidence of breast cancer than others in the United States, African American women have a higher mortality or a higher death rate, and therefore a lower survival of breast cancer in this country. So it's really very important. Not only are the tumors more aggressive, they are larger at diagnosis and tend to spread faster, but they are diagnosed in younger women than in other racial or ethnic groups in this country. So therefore, this is very important. There have been a number of research studies and clinical trials trying to identify why there are differences among racial and ethnic groups and why African Americans tend to have a higher mortality or a higher death rate. And no one has yet found all of the answers, and therefore it is very important to participate in clinical trials so that some of these answers can hopefully be gained by carefully conducted clinical trials. It is very well recognized that African American women in general tend to have tumors that grow more rapidly. They spread to other areas, such as the lymph nodes, faster, and therefore very, very important to find out also why are these tumors developing in younger women. It is important, and you will hear from other speakers later, regarding treatment options and treatment planning, as well as early diagnosis of cancer. So therefore, very important to participate in screening so that the appropriate studies are done very early, so that the cancer is found very early, and therefore the options for treatment itemized and evaluated, and therefore each person can choose a treatment plan that is specific for the individual. It is very important that once a diagnosis of breast cancer is made, that the patient select a healthcare team, and I mean a healthcare team that might consist of a surgeon, a medical oncologist, social workers, nurses, treatment planning groups, as well as insurance specialists who can help obtain insurance and coverage for various procedures. So having that healthcare team that plans for the patient, that communicates well with the patient, is very important. It's very important for the individual patient to have someone else accompany them to appointments. This someone else could be a friend, a relative, a spouse, but someone else who can help with the communication. Communicating with the healthcare team is very important, and therefore the patient should feel comfortable with that healthcare team. So selecting a team, selecting an institution where one would receive care, very important. I've mentioned clinical trials earlier, and it is true that not enough African-American women participate in clinical trials and therefore have access to some of the latest technology, the latest treatment planning, which is very important. And there are many reasons for not participating in clinical trials, such as worry about access to care, worry about cost, worry about previous historical events such as the Tuskegee incident in the past. So it's very important to obtain clinical information from many sources. I refer a lot of my patients to clinicaltrials.gov and others, but you will hear from our other speakers specific information regarding surgery, regarding treatment, and therefore it's very important to communicate with the healthcare team, get as much information as one can so that one can plan their own treatment plan. Therefore, I tell my patients information is power, and it's very important for African-American women to avail themselves of information, of clinical trials regarding breast cancer, so that they can empower themselves to take control, to take care of themselves, so that hopefully my goal in the next few years is that we will find an improvement in the overall care of African-American women with breast cancer, so that we no longer see this gap between survival rates among African-American women and other women with breast cancer in this country. So I thank you very much, and it is a pleasure for me to be with you on this telephone call today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mitchell, for just really setting a wonderful beginning for the program. Thank you so much, and I know there will be questions for you as the call goes on, so thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. Lisa Newman. Dr. Newman is Director of Breast Care Center, Professor of Surgery, University of Michigan, Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Newman is going to address the role of surgery in the treatment of breast cancer and the importance of the sentinel node biopsy. She's going to talk about understanding the pathology report and an overview of reconstructive surgery. Dr. Newman.
Thank you, and I would also like to add my appreciation to Dr. Messner for putting together this wonderful teleconference. So as you mentioned, I will be talking about some of the surgical aspects of care for breast cancer patients, and indeed, surgery will be an essential component of care for the vast majority of breast cancer patients diagnosed in this era, because just as you would like to remove a malignant tumor of the colon or the lung or wherever it is found in an individual's body, it's essential to try to remove that tumor as well with the breast so that you can prevent progression of the cancer. And in the case of breast cancers, if they are left untreated, they can cause ulcerations in the skin. They can cause very severe disability or problems with use of the arm because of that spread, and they can certainly be very unsightly and quite uncomfortable. Also, surgery will be an essential component to avoid progression of that cancer to other parts of the body, or what we call metastatic spread to other organs. And for breast cancer, this is generally going to be the way that most breast cancers will threaten our survival, by metastasizing to other organs and damaging those other organs. And so early detection will be critical for breast cancer patients. With early detection, or catching the cancer at a smaller size, when it has not progressed to the point where it has affected the glands or the lymph nodes at the underarm area that drain the breast, to catch the cancer before it has metastasized to any significant degree to other parts of the body, this early detection is going to be critical, because it will leave the patient with more surgical options in controlling that cancer. And it, in many cases, will result in that newly diagnosed breast cancer patients being able to have less extensive treatment. The women with the earliest stage breast cancer at diagnosis are more likely to be able to avoid treatments such as chemotherapy, for example. And now, before I go on to talk any further about surgery, I'd like to just deviate a little bit to make another comment relative to the early detection discussion, and this is a comment regarding the mammography controversy that recently resurfaced over the fall of this past year. Many of you on the call, I realize, are women who have already undergone treatment for breast cancer, and so you're already living with the disease. But you guys, as ambassadors to the general population of women out there, frequently are providing guidance to your family members and to the general public regarding breast cancer screening needs. And so the controversy that emerged this past fall was that there was a particular group, the United States Preventive Services Task Force, that issued updated mammographic screening guidelines where they were recommending that women wait until the age of 50 to start having screening mammograms. Now, many of the well-established and highly revered professional societies, such as the American College of Surgeons, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, the advocacy organizations such as American Cancer Society, these professional organizations and advocacy groups have continued to recommend that mammograms be performed starting at age 40. And what I want to emphasize in this teleconference is that starting the mammograms at age 40 is even more important for African American women. As you heard Dr. Mitchell very eloquently describe already, we see particular patterns of breast cancer in African American women, which make mammographic screening during the 40s even more critical. African American women are more likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer when they're in their 40s compared to women of other racial ethnic backgrounds, and we are more likely to develop some of the biologically more aggressive patterns of disease, and so catching these cancers earlier with mammographic screening is that much more critical. So again, the take-home message is that mammogram starting at age 40 is important for all women, but even more important for African American women. So now I'm going to go back to the discussion of surgery, and the remainder of my comments are really relevant to women of any racial ethnic background in terms of managing their disease. So for early stage breast cancer, we have to take into consideration a few basic issues when we come up with a treatment plan. Number one, we want to remove the cancerous lump, whichever area led to the diagnosis of the breast cancer to begin with. For breast cancer, we know that many patients, indeed 40 to 50% of patients, will have microscopic breast cancer cells in other parts of the breast separate from where the lump was diagnosed and biopsied. And we need to adequately stage the cancer, not only by studying the cancerous lump in the laboratory, but also by checking the lymph nodes of the underarm area or the axillary lymph nodes. Looking at these glands from the underarm area gives us some idea of whether or not the cancer might have also spread on a microscopic basis to other parts of the body. And so the surgical plan for the newly diagnosed breast cancer patient must address all of these issues. These different issues, to be addressed comprehensively, basically leaves us with two different treatment strategies for the newly diagnosed breast cancer patient. One strategy is the mastectomy, which is the oldest form of surgical treatment for breast cancer. And with a mastectomy, we're really addressing all three issues with one operation because we are removing the entire breast, so we're getting rid of the cancerous lump and any microscopic cancer that might be hiding in surrounding breast tissue. And through the mastectomy incision, we will remove whatever lymph nodes need to be analyzed from the underarm area, again, through that same operative field, through the same incision. However, breast-saving surgery is equally effective compared to mastectomy in controlling the disease of breast cancer, but we just do it in a slightly different way. With breast-conserving or breast-saving surgery, we do a lumpectomy where we just remove the portion of the breast that has the cancerous lump hiding within it. We make a separate incision in the underarm area to do whatever axillary surgery is necessary to remove whatever lymph nodes or glands need to be checked in the laboratory. And then we recommend radiation treatments to the patient to treat the surrounding breast tissue, the remaining breast tissue, and to kill any microscopic cancer cells that might be hiding in that remaining breast tissue. Now, I want to emphasize, again, breast-conserving surgery is equivalent to mastectomy when it comes to survival. For the vast majority of breast cancer patients, the outcome or the survival rates will be determined by catching the cancer at an early enough stage before it has metastasized, even on a microscopic basis, to other organs, or if it has metastasized on a microscopic basis to other organs, then survival will depend on our ability to control that disease in other organs with other non-surgical treatments, such as chemotherapy, such as cancer-fighting pills, or such as other exciting targeted therapies called trastuzumab, which I'm sure you'll be hearing about as the teleconference progresses as well. But we obviously do not necessarily want to give some of these non-surgical treatments, such as chemotherapy, to all women because it is very difficult for many women to take, but it can, in fact, be life-saving. So when necessary, it is extremely important that women accept it. But knowing who should or should not receive these treatments is equally critical. One of the most important ways to determine who needs chemotherapy is going to be in checking the lymph nodes of the underarm area. And in the past, we did this surgery for all breast cancer patients by performing an operation called an axillary lymph node dissection, where we would basically remove the fat pad of the underarm area and examine all of the lymph nodes present in that tissue. this operation can put women at risk for a side effect called lymphedema, or a tendency to have swelling of the arm. And so an alternative surgical approach has developed called sentinel lymph node biopsy, where we remove just the most important lymph nodes responsible for draining the breast, and these are called the sentinel lymph nodes. If the sentinel lymph nodes are negative, then we can avoid the axillary lymph node dissection. But if we do find disease in those sentinel lymph nodes, then we do recommend the axillary lymph node dissection. But in any woman that is found to have cancer in those lymph nodes, chemotherapy will almost always be necessary. Now, I'm going to switch gears and talk a bit about the pathology report of a woman being evaluated for a breast problem. It's critical that any woman who has a biopsy of any type, whether it's cancerous or benign of her breast, it's important for her to keep records of her pathology information. If she was told that she had a benign problem, then the pathology report will sometimes be useful in determining whether she is at higher risk for getting breast cancer in the future, in which case she may want to consider taking medication to avoid or to reduce her chances of getting breast cancer. She may be a candidate for genetic counseling. Some women will even opt to have a prevention mastectomy on the basis of finding a benign pathology report indicating a higher risk of getting breast cancer in the future. If the pathology report does indicate cancer, then keeping records of that pathology report is important to identify the stage of the disease, which is determined by the size of the cancer and by the lymph node status, such as the number of lymph nodes in the underarm area that are involved with the cancer. And determining treatment will be based upon the pattern of the cancer, in particular whether that cancer expresses any of the three markers, estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, or the HER2-new marker. And then the last thing that I'd like to touch upon is the concept of breast reconstruction. Breast reconstruction is a wonderful modality for women that require a mastectomy for their breast cancer. And some women will have a mastectomy either because of the pattern of their disease or because of medical issues that made them not very good candidates for a lumpectomy. And some women, simply for personal preferences, will desire a mastectomy as opposed to breast-conserving surgery or a lumpectomy. And for these women, breast reconstruction can be performed with wonderful results by the plastic surgeons. The breast reconstruction can either be done in a delayed fashion, months or years after the mastectomy, or it can be done at the same time as the mastectomy, which is what we call immediate breast reconstruction. But some patients, because of medical issues or because of issues related to their breast cancer, it might be preferable for the woman to receive all of her cancer treatment first and then to have breast reconstruction in the form of a delayed reconstruction. Whether it's performed at the same time as the mastectomy or even years later, the reconstruction can either be done with an implant or it can be done using the patient's own body tissue, which is usually what we call the tram flap reconstruction, where we take tissue from the abdomen and recreate the breast mound. Sometimes it can be we can utilize back muscle and tissue from the back of the woman to recreate the breast mound. Very important to not be aware of some risk factors for complications related to breast reconstruction. Breast reconstruction can be more difficult and associated with higher complication rates in women that are smokers or who have a smoking history and women that are obese. But for those women who do have breast reconstruction, we want to reassure them that it will not affect their recurrence rate. It will not cause the cancer to come back, and it does not impair our ability to follow that patient in the future. And I will stop there, and I look forward to hearing the other speakers. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Newman, for just an excellent presentation. Very informative and really covering a lot of questions that people have. And also reminding everyone to be sure to get copies of all those reports that are generated about you so you have your own reports that you can look at. That's very important. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Jen Rosa Grana. And Dr. Grana is a frequent presenter on our programs as well. She's Director of Breast Cancer Program, Cooper Hospital, UMC, Associate Professor of Medicine, University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Robert Wood Johnson School of Medicine. As you can see, all of our speakers wear many hats here. And Dr. Grana is going to address the role of a medical oncologist, the current standard of care and new treatment approaches, practical tips for symptom and pain management, and the whole issue of coordination of care, including radiation therapy and follow-up long-term care. Dr. Grana.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here. The role of the medical oncologist is an important one, but as Dr. Mitchell commented, it really is a team that manages a patient, and the oncologist is but a member of that team. Once the surgery is completed, the medical oncologist is usually the one that sits down with the patient to discuss the pathology, the characteristics of the tumor, and how that will affect risk of recurrence and future management. When we think of risk of recurrence, we need to think about the risk that this cancer may come back in the breast, the risk that this cancer may come back in distant organs, but we also need to think about what is the risk of cancer occurring in the opposite breast, and how does family history play into this? The decisions on further therapy beyond surgery and beyond radiation are based specifically on the characteristics that were already discussed about the tumor. How big is the tumor? How many lymph nodes are involved? And in particular, certain features such as estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2/neu status. But in addition to looking at the tumor features, we also have to pay attention to the patient's health status, because some patients may tolerate one treatment versus another, and also to the patient's wishes. And it's very important that we communicate with the patient, because some women still have not had their first child and are interested in preserving fertility. Other women have a real strong focus on not losing their hair. So it really is an active dialogue between the oncologist and the patient to come up with a treatment plan that's right for that particular patient. So I said that the management depends on the tumor, but it also depends on the patient and the patient's health and wishes. The field of oncology is really changing. In the past, all we relied on were some of these more crude measures of tumor behavior. We can predict from tumor size and nodes the likelihood that this cancer may relapse in the future, and we would then select appropriate drugs. We're now moving in an area where we're looking at the genetic factors of, or the genetic profiles of cancers to determine the behavior of the cancer. So, for example, some of you may have known or may have had done oncotype testing, which is pertinent for cancers that are hormone receptor positive. It's not for that triple negative cancer that we sometimes see in the African-American woman. But oncotype testing for the pertinent cancer helps us get a very fine-tuned idea of the future behavior of the cancer, and it can help us determine whether a woman can be treated with just a hormonal agent or whether she would need chemotherapy. There's also some early data that that type of test may actually help predict risk of recurrence in the breast or after a mastectomy. Now, again, the oncotype test is not pertinent for cancers that are estrogen receptor and progesterone receptor negative or HER2/neu positive, so I think the job of the oncologist is to sit down with you and decide when this new technology can be of value, when it should be utilized. But I hope that in the future we're going to have tests like oncotype that may be pertinent for these other tumors that we are still grappling with. So a decision then is made between the oncologist and the patient that revolves around whether chemotherapy needs to be utilized, whether hormone therapy needs to be utilized, or whether both. And so how is that decided? Again, patient and physician together. But there are many chemotherapy regimens that can be selected. These are drug regimens. Some of you may have had adriamycin and Cytoxan, AC. Some of you may have had AC followed by Taxol. Some of you may have had Taxotere Cytoxan. They're cocktails that are put together with the premise of killing any residual cells. And, again, we've gotten to be very good at selecting these drugs. I'll talk a little bit more about management of symptoms as we get through this discussion. Typical hormonal therapies include tamoxifen, the aromatase inhibitors such as Arimidex, Femara, or Aromycin. And again, some women are offered both of these options. Some women are offered biologic compounds such as Herceptin for those cancers that are HER2/neu positive. And we are now in an era where some women are offered biologic compounds such as Avastin. There are several studies going on across the country in early stage breast cancer, some prior to surgery, some after surgery, that are studying whether this new drug may have a role in early stage breast cancer. We don't have the answer to that. That's why it's important that the clinical trials be done so we can clarify and identify new drugs that will improve the outcome for women. Obviously, in the African-American community, we're very interested in this concept of triple negative subgroups of cancers. These are cancers that are estrogen, progesterone, and HER2 negative, as has been discussed. These cancers are more common in African-American women, younger African-American particularly, and there is a lot of work being done with these cancers looking at new drugs. Again, new drugs such as Avastin, new drugs such as platinum compounds, new drugs such as PARP inhibitors, which we can talk about later. But again, I think the future is going to be very rich in terms of options for managing those particular cancers that are of interest in the African-American community. So what is the key in managing breast cancer? The key is really to make the right choices on treatment and that those choices be made by good communication between the patient and the healthcare team. These are not mandates from the oncologist. They really are a back-and-forth discussion and debate that has to happen. Also, key to the success of getting through chemotherapy is working with your healthcare team to manage symptoms, to manage all of the myriad of symptoms that come with chemotherapy. And again, it's important to have a team that you're comfortable with, to have a team that you can communicate with, and to have a team that will work with you to address your symptoms and your pertinent issues. Many patients who are getting chemotherapy for early stage breast cancer will have fatigue, will have nausea, will have other symptoms that actually have a lot of new available treatment strategies. So we have new anti-nausea medications. Some of you have heard about Emend. Some of you have heard about a patch that can be used in the chest wall. We have Neupogen and Neulasta that can protect the patients from infection. So clearly, it is important for the team to put this together with the patient. And finally, I want to touch base on coordination of care. And again, as has been said before, this is a team effort. The surgeon, the medical oncologist, the radiation oncologist, nursing, genetic counseling for some women, all of that needs to be in play. Oftentimes, one of the key pieces is deciding who goes first in this process. Does surgery go first or chemotherapy go first? Where does radiation fit in? So again, the medical oncologist is often one of the people on this team that helps patients try to coordinate care, decide when the timing of radiation should be. Again, referring you to a radiation oncologist, although the surgeon often does that as well. And if radiation is to be delivered, when the time is correct, whether it should be pre-chemotherapy or after. The other important job for the medical oncologist is really once the chemotherapy plan is done or if a woman is just getting hormonal therapy, to really put a follow-up plan together for the patient with some goals for long-term care. And it's important not just to discuss with the patient what the follow-up plan is, but also to communicate that follow-up plan with the primary care physician. You all have a primary care physician. They are a very important part of your team, and it's important that that primary care physician know what treatment you've gotten, what treatment you may continue to get, such as a hormonal agent, what the expected future toxicities of these treatments may be, so that as he's following you along for the next 5, 10, and 15 years, he will be aware of what needs to be done, what needs to be monitored for, and when to send you back for further intervention from the oncology team. Your oncologist, your surgeon, your radiation therapist will continue to follow you on a set schedule, initially every 3 to 4 months for the first couple of years, then every 6 months for the first 5 years, and then once a year after 5 years. But again, that primary care physician is there much more commonly for you, and they are a very important part of this team. So, again, with that, I would say that the job of the medical oncologist is to be a member of the team and to help coordinate many of the pieces that are in need of coordination and to really discuss treatment options. And I'll stop here.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Grana, for just a really excellent presentation, very comprehensive, and really covering these topics really very well. And I think that I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Vanessa Shepherd, and Dr. Shepherd is Assistant Professor, Cancer Control Program, Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center, Georgetown University. And Dr. Shepherd is going to address the issues of informed decision-making and genetic counseling and testing. These are very important issues to consider and to be aware of. And I'm going to turn the program over to Dr. Shepherd.
Good afternoon. I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak about these particular issues that are pertinent to African-American breast cancer survivors and their families. Informed decision-making and genetic testing are particularly important because, as many of us know, cancer treatments have become increasingly more sophisticated. And, for example, for some women, clinical decisions about her treatment will be straightforward with clear supporting evidence, but for other women, the decisions may be more difficult. And as a result, the interest in informed decision-making and shared decision-making has grown in recent years. We know that when women make informed decisions, that they're more likely to complete their treatment and the quality of care that they receive is better. A 35-year-old woman just received two sets of news. The first news brought joy, learning that she's pregnant. The other news brought disbelief, fear, and more questions. She has breast cancer. How will treatment impact her child? When should I have surgery? Should I continue with the pregnancy or seek to terminate the pregnancy? To some extent, the decisions that she makes and when she seeks treatment and makes those decisions will have an impact on her outcomes. When women are faced with these decisions, it is important that their decisions be informed. Informed decision-making is described as occurring when a woman understands her breast cancer and comprehends what the treatment involves, including its benefits, its risks, limitations, alternatives, and the uncertainties. It also uncovers when it considers her preferences and makes a decision that's consistent with those preferences, and also when women believe that she has they have participated in decisions at their level of desired decision-making. For example, some women may want to be fully involved, while others may want the information but feel comfortable having the physician lead out in the final decision. Informed decision-making interventions such as decision boards and print materials are often used to facilitate a woman making an informed decision. As you can tell, informed decision-making is really multifaceted. It's not giving consent to a procedure. It involves the information exchange between a woman and her provider, and also that women's preferences are included. Again, some women may want to include their family members, and other women may choose not to. Some of the questions that women at our center have asked include, what does my doctor recommend? For some women, they don't feel that they've received a clear recommendation because they feel that physicians have asked their opinion. So it's important to recognize that in today's medical environment that many physicians expect that you will share in decisions about your treatment. And to some extent, it's because there's much information that's available. However, you should always feel comfortable to tell your physicians how you prefer to make decisions. To participate actively in the decision-making process, it's important to understand basic words that are used and also for women to feel comfortable. Some other questions that women have asked are, will I need chemotherapy? And if so, will I have to take off work? Could I avoid chemotherapy by taking other treatments? What we found is that a woman's understanding of these questions has impacted their treatment decisions. And while these questions are similar to other racial ethnic groups, there is some data that suggests that compared to Caucasian American women, African-American women are more likely to report feeling less involved in their care and to ask fewer questions. Also, some studies have found that not all African-American women receive optimal treatment. So one important pathway to receive appropriate treatment is to ensure that women are able to make an informed decision and that women are able to be their own best advocates. We encourage women to talk back. And simply, this is encouraging women to tell their story to their providers. And this includes your values, your preferences, any barriers that really could impact returning to your facility for multiple treatments, and to ask questions and to write those questions down and take a list in. And oftentimes, you may have more than one encounter may be necessary to have all your questions answered. We encourage women to listen actively, to take notes. And Dr. Mitchell pointed out that it's often helpful to take a person with you to your appointments because oftentimes that other person may hear things that you may miss. And also to know your options. And we encourage women to write out the benefits of the given treatment, to write out those risks. And many of us make decisions all the time. And so we encourage that we build upon the tools that we already have and use those tools as we interact in our medical encounters. I'd like to briefly talk about genetic testing and counseling because as we uncover and discover more information about genes and use genomic information, this is the area where informed decision-making is very important. As many of you know, more and more we're hearing about breast cancer genes and genetic tests are in the news, and it's often difficult to make sense of this information. For many women, they may understand and know their family history of breast cancer, and for other families, this may not have been discussed. In considering, should I have a genetic test for breast cancer, and what happens after I may receive that test? It is important to know that in relating genes to breast cancer, that most cancer actually occurs by chance and is not due to a single inherited environmental cause. If a gene contains a mutation, or what's also referred to as a mistake, it may not work properly. In fact, many of us have several mutations, many of which will never cause us any harm. However, there are certain mutations that can increase the risk for illnesses such as cancer. These mutations can be passed down from the parent to a child, which are called inherited, or other mutations that sort of happen sporadically during our lifetime. And in terms of breast cancer genes, scientists have found identified primarily two gene mutations that cause breast cancer, and these are called BRCA1 and BRCA2, or sometimes referred to as BRCA1 and 2. And it's believed that about 5 to 10% of these breast cancers are caused by inherited BRCA1 or 2 mutations. What this does mean is that the vast majority of breast cancers, 90 to 95%, actually occur by chance. Some of you may have heard that Ashkenazi Jewish women are more likely to have these mutations because that's a particular ethnic group that's been studied probably the most frequently in regards to BRCA1 and 2. However, it's important to note that African American women are just as likely as non-Ashkenazi Jewish Caucasian women to have BRCA1 and 2. And it's very important then that counseling and testing go hand in hand. So I'll talk briefly about some of the risks for a woman who carries this mutation. And if a woman carries this particular mutation, she will be more likely to develop breast cancer than women without this mutation in the general population. It's very difficult to estimate what that exact risk figure is because other factors such as age come into play to understand this. The test for this genetic risk is typically a blood test. It could also be taken with swabs from your inner cheek. In many instances, women may have testing without counseling, but we strongly recommend that women actually receive counseling and meet with a genetic counselor along with their provider to go through information that they may have to determine, are they at high risk to even have the test and should they have the test. And this is primarily because genetic testing is much more complex than just a yes or no. And oftentimes, the information that's received back can be very complicated and complex, and women may be uncertain what to do with that information, how to talk to their family members, or when to involve their family members. And we strongly suggest that counseling take place hand-in-hand with testing to understand the results. In closing, I'd just like to highlight that genetic information is also increasingly being used to inform treatment recommendations. Dr. Grana has already mentioned Oncotype, which some of you may have had that test. One small study, though, interestingly found that most women did not understand the results of the test. And so it's very important that if you receive these genetic results, that you make it clear that you don't understand that information. It's important that your physician go over those results with you and that you understand how this information is being used to guide your treatment plan. And again, if you feel unsure or don't understand these results, it's okay to go through it again so you're not confused or don't have any unnecessary worry. In closing, we recognize that women and their families often receive a lot of information from many sources, and it can actually be overwhelming. And, you know, we like to tell women that it's okay to take time to go through their information, to bring that information in with your provider. Sometimes we receive information that actually may not be in accordance to what we're hearing from our provider, and so we really encourage women to bring that information in, to review it with their provider. And it's the right of every woman and her family to make decisions that are informed and that are acceptable to her preferences. As one of our survivor advocates says, she says, go in informed, and you come out even better informed. And I'll stop there.
Oh, that's a great, thank you so much. Really an excellent presentation, and what a great line that is. That is so fantastic, and I really can't thank you enough, and I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Alicia Ellis. Alicia is an oncology social worker, and she is clinical coordinator of women's cancers at Cancer Care. And she's going to tell you a bit about the services that you can access at Cancer Care. Alicia?
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As you had mentioned, I'm one of the oncology social workers here at Cancer Care, and I wanted to take a few minutes to talk about Cancer Care services and how Cancer Care can be a part of your support network. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care offers individual counseling, support groups, educational materials, and limited financial assistance. All of our services are confidential, free of charge, and offered by professionally trained oncology social workers. You can access additional information on Cancer Care services by calling 800-813-4673 or by visiting our website, cancercare.org. Listening to today's presentation, we've learned the current standards of care, clinical trials, and practical tips for managing treatment. It is important to think about the many ways in which a breast cancer diagnosis affects not only you, but also your loved ones. You may be confronted with a variety of emotions and concerns, and some people may be experiencing feelings of fear, frustration, isolation, and embarrassment. There are some unique concerns women with breast cancer may have, including concerns about the impact of surgery and treatment on one's lifestyle and self-perception. All of these concerns are relevant and important to discuss. We encourage you to leverage your healthcare team, friends, family, and existing sources of emotional, social, and spiritual support. In addition, Cancer Care's oncology social workers can help you navigate the treatment and post-treatment with not only your treatment team, but also with your spouses, partners, and other loved ones. Many breast cancer partners, spouses, family members, and friends are also affected in ways that may be difficult to discuss. Physical changes, including the loss of hair, changes in skin color, weight, and energy levels may be difficult issues to address with family or friends. Opening up communication between you and your caregivers is another way in which oncology social workers can help. Finally, many people diagnosed with breast cancer and caregivers find support through joining a support group. Support groups help connect you to other people in similar situations. The intention of a group is to provide a safe space for you to discuss any concerns or feelings associated with the diagnosis. Cancer Care offers support groups in three different formats. We offer face-to-face support groups in our New Jersey, and Connecticut offices. For our national clients, we offer telephone support groups and online groups as a way for you to connect with others affected by breast cancer. For more information on our support groups or other confidential services for people affected by a breast cancer diagnosis, please call 800-813-4673 or visit our website at cancercare.org. I'd also like to mention that we provide the social work support for the triple negative breast cancer helpline, and that number is 877-880-8622. Please remember, you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to provide support to you. I thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you all today.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Alicia, for a wonderful presentation and really for making very much real to everybody all the different services that Cancer Care does offer, and they're actually available to everyone at no cost and through an 800 number or our website. So please do contact us. And now we have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board, to open all their lines, and also I'm going to ask her to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, you will please call us after the call at the number that Alicia gave, 1-800-813-HOPE, and our staff will be here to try to help you with your questions and concerns. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Esther S.
Dietary status and return of breast cancer. Is there any information you can provide on that?
And Esther, could you repeat your question? We missed the beginning of it.
Yes, my name is Claudia Oob, and I am asking if there is a relationship in your dietary status and a return of cancer, and also is there a relationship between multiple myeloma, since it was mentioned that other cancers may come, is there a relationship between multiple myeloma and breast cancer?
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you for those questions. Esther, I'm going to ask Dr. Grana to address those questions. Dr. Grana?
Oh, thank you. First of all, the relationship between nutrition and cancer recurrence. There have been a couple of interesting trials spearheaded out of by a group in California that suggested that weight loss after diagnosis of breast cancer, an aggressive nutritional approach that included a low-fat diet along with exercise and some weight loss may actually be very beneficial and help reduce risk of recurrence. So I do think there are things that a woman can do that will lower her risk. Now, there also is some data on alcohol intake and exercise being low alcohol intake being protective, exercise being protective. So I think a very active lifestyle with good nutrition makes sense. I'm not aware, and others may comment, of any specific relationship between multiple myeloma and breast cancer. One of the breast cancer genes has an array, BRCA2 has an array of cancers that one can see with it, but I'm not aware of multiple myeloma being a part of that.
Excellent. Any other speaker want to comment on that? Okay. What we would recommend is that you actually, Esther, for that second question, you would call the National Cancer Institute. 1-800-4-CANCER. That information is in all your materials that you got from us, and that's a really good place to ask a question like that. They would be able to do some research for you on that and see if there's any information on that. Thank you. Excellent questions. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Gloria T.
Hello.
Hi, Gloria. Your question?
My question is for Dr. Shepherd. On the two types of testing, my daughter has just been diagnosed with stage 5 cancer, and very healthy, like a 37-year-old female. So she has what I think is a good team. She's at the university, with the University of Virginia.
And so how old is your daughter again?
I'm sorry?
How old is your daughter?
She's seven.
Seven.
Very healthy, followed up with all of her physicals, just diagnosed from 1 year to the next with the lump. So she is now being prepared for chemo. And my question is, they're fighting us on the testing, because what we understand is that certain testings will prove that there are certain procedures for black African-American women compared to white women or other women. So how do we get our insurance, her insurance, to look at this as a problem for a black American or African American?
Well, this is in many parts to your question, and I know they're going to want to talk with you, Gloria, after the call, because we're going to try to address some of your questions. Your daughter is very young. I'm going to first ask Dr. Grana to address just the issue of your daughter's age and breast cancer.
Well, I think she said 37, if that's
mm-hmm.
correct.
37. Okay.
Right.
All right.
So is this an unusual age? No. We are seeing increasing rates of breast cancer in young African-American women, and it highlights the need for consideration of genetic testing in someone like this, because it can help decide how to manage the breast, whether the ovaries need to be managed, and what to do for the rest of the family. So I think that's very important. The issue of other tests that are being denied by insurance, I'd really be interested to see what that is. We have had in our, I'm in New Jersey, and we have had some problems across the board getting certain heart scans approved, but I'm not aware of other things that are being denied by insurance. So I'd be interested to see what kind of things are being denied by insurance. And
Dr.
that's
Shepherd,
something that can be fought if there's data that they're of value.
And that's a very good point. And actually, I would say that many of these companies that do the testing actually have financial office people to assist with it. Our staff help with that as well. And you're right, these things can be appealed. If they're denied, they're definitely, it would be information as to why this is important. Dr. Shepherd, did you want to add?
I guess I just would like to echo that, you know, we have had some instances where maybe women wanted genetic testing, for example, and so working really closely with either an oncology social worker or a navigator have helped to either put another complaint in to the insurance company or to help them locate free testing for genetic testing. Particularly when there have been several local programs that we've had access to where either we've connected women with a research study and they were able to get genetic testing through the study for free, or several of the companies actually do offer on a need basis free testing. And so what we've been able to do in a few instances is working really closely with the navigator and then that patient's provider to ensure that they haven't been denied care.
Alicia, do you want to add anything in terms of all the people that you're working with and this issue in terms of the getting tests that people want to have?
I think part of it is having the conversation with the medical team. I think finances tends to be one of the reasons that people are sometimes leery, but I think part of this is treating the treatment process and the search for resources like it is a bit of a job. And it is a matter of reaching out to resources like Cancer Care and, as you mentioned, the National Cancer Institutes to see what resources are out there.
Excellent. And so, Gloria, definitely contact our staff here. We'll talk to you after the call as well. The other thing just for everyone to know is that, and I think it was said by Dr. Grana, Dr. Mitchell, Dr. Shepherd, Dr. Newman, that these tests that have been developed are very important. And maybe as a concluding remark, I wonder if Dr. Grana, if you want to just comment on just the role that these tests are playing now in terms of helping to make people to really be able to determine what they need to do in terms of their treatment protocol.
Yeah, I think the tests that we currently have run the gamut from radiology studies that are important in treatment planning. So, for example, the heart scans, potentially the PET scans or CAT scans and MRIs that are needed to manage the breast and manage other areas, to these oncotype tumor tests that help us decide on the right treatment for a particular woman, and then finally the genetic tests that are done to determine if a woman is a carrier of a mutation in BRCA1 and BRCA2. So they're all very different types of tests, yet they each are important. Sometimes not every woman needs all of these tests. Not every woman is a candidate for Oncotype. Not every woman needs BRCA1 and 2 testing. But when appropriate, they're very important in helping us manage that woman and oftentimes picking the right treatment and picking the right surgery and even picking the management for the family as a whole. So I think you need to be very proactive in this.
And we hope that you'll take that message with all of you. And there are many messages, that many things, much information that you've all heard today. We're hoping you'll take the information about really working with your healthcare team around the information you've learned and really actively exploring whether you can have these tests and getting them if you feel are important, talking to your healthcare team if they're important for you to have, and then working with the not doing this alone, knowing that all of our speakers have said this is a team effort, and you're a part of that team. And so those conversations and your communication with the team and appealing anything that is not in your best interest you feel is very important. I hope this call has been helpful to all of you. As we conclude the program today, I want to thank our speakers. They've been just wonderful. Fabulous group of speakers, I have to say. I want to also thank all of you who've asked such great questions, really terrific questions. And I want to thank all of you who have been listening as well. I don't want anyone to leave this call today feeling that you're alone. I want you to now know that you're part of a community of support. There are lots of resources for you. You do not have to do this alone. If we talk about teams in terms of your treatment, you too need sometimes to extend the team for support. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and please do contact us and really do work with us so we can get you the best help possible. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.